Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu. Welcome back to the Early Morning Sunday Show with me, Anisa Isak. And we are at our final slot for this morning, which is the Conscious Consumer with Mufti Mohammed Hafiji of the Economics and Finance Desk of the Jamaatul Ulama South Africa. Mufti, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu and welcome.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu and jazakallah for having me once again.
Well, we're speaking about some interesting things today, and I must also inform you that I've had some very, very good feedback from a number of ladies who in the different groups that I belong to who listen in on a Sunday morning and are very grateful for the bits of information that you share with them and with me. And we do say Jazakallah Khair for that, because it has really been an education and opened our eyes as well as made us very aware of what to look for and be able to keep away from things that we that may be of I wouldn't say danger, but could be detrimental to us in a certain way.
Yes, indeed. I acknowledge the compliment, but I must acknowledge that I cannot take all the credit. It's a joint initiative from both of us. So for me, it's also a learning curve and also empowering for myself as we decide on the specific topics that need to be shared with our listeners.
Right, shukran for that. Well, we're looking today at the wage gap, so the wage gap conundrum, how employment still contributes to inequality. Tell us exactly what you mean by that.
You know, I'm sure our listeners by now have realized that every now and then, together with identifying topics that are relevant for ordinary consumers, we try to pick up on issues which are purely related to economics and finance. And the aspect that you inquire about in terms of wage gap conundrum, this is purely related to economics now, and what I'll try to do in the next few minutes is just simplify what we're trying to talk about when it comes to the whole wage gap conundrum and how even employment still contributes to inequality. Let me begin by saying that when it comes to the topic of inequality, many individuals are deluded into believing that if there is widespread employment, employment in itself is the end game, in the sense that it will alleviate inequality. This is, tends to be misconstrued and is a misnomer, because as you'll see from the next few moments, even employment in the current setting in the South African environment still has potential to contribute towards and exacerbate inequality. Let's start by saying that when it comes to traditional pay design in South Africa, there are three important elements. The first element is that of what we call total guaranteed package. The total guaranteed package is the value of the fixed pay that an employee receives. So it may be a nominal figure, an exact number that the employment receives. That's the one element within the traditional pay design. The second is the short-term incentives, which are performance-driven and are designed to pay out within periods of less than a year. Any benefit or additional privileges that are paid out to the employee within the within a given year. And then the third element, which informs the traditional pay design, is the long-term incentives, which are designed to drive performance and even retain staff over the longer term, and typically have a vesting period or a time to pay out of between 3 and 5 years. So these are the three elements that contribute to the traditional pay design: the total guaranteed package, short-term incentives, and long-term incentives. The interesting part to note in the South African context is that when you look at the figures, the employment figures, you find that even if all employees, from the most senior employees to the most junior employees, even though these three elements apply to all levels of employment, you will still find that the privileges of short-term incentives and long-term incentives, the last two elements that I talked about, are most enjoyed by the higher end of the employees in any given organization. So if you look at the figures and when you punch the figures into a graph and you plot it on a graph, you find that the senior employees or the higher level of employees actually gain more than junior or lower level employees. So and this is purely because the higher level of employees tend to be entitled to short-term or even long-term incentives faster or quicker than your lower level of employees. So they, mm-hmm. so the point at which they begin to benefit from short-term and long-term incentives is much more earlier than the lower level of employees. So that's what, on the one hand. On the other hand, if you look at the South African, or let's take the international measures of unemployment or inequality rather, the international measure in conventional economics to measure inequality is the Gini coefficient. The Gini coefficient is a very simple concept for ordinary laymen to understand, in the sense that it's a measure of inequality between 0 and 1. So the closer any nation comes to 1, it indicates towards a more unequal society, right? And the closer to 0, you're much more in terms of maintaining equality in terms of income in the country. In South Africa specifically, according to the World Bank, South Africa has the second highest Gini coefficient in the world, which is 0.63. Our Gini coefficient is at 0.63, which means that we're very close to 1, and this means that we are highly unequal in terms of income distribution. Mm-hmm. Now, just to come to the wage gap conundrum again, if you just take the employed individuals, the active labor force in South Africa, and you apply the same Gini coefficient measurement tools, and you determine the level of inequality, even among employed individuals, you will find that the Gini coefficient result still comes out to 0.45, which is, so if you look at it, even though you're measuring employed individuals, you're still arriving at a much more higher or even a high Gini coefficient, which means that even if you look at employed individuals, there is still inequality among employed individuals. And hence we arrive at the conclusion that employment in itself is not an end in itself. It's not the only tool that will alleviate inequality. Rather, what has to be done is, if we as a society are serious about reducing the wage gap or becoming more equitable in terms of the labor market and society, perhaps we may need to review our traditional remuneration package design principles. And this is something which is very rare in many organizations, taken for granted in terms of making sure that a remuneration package is fair, it is designed properly, and it takes into account realistic measures that are well established in economic theory. So the easy way to do it is to standardize the percentage to which all employees enjoy benefits, right? You say across mm-hmm. the board, irrespective of how senior or how junior the employee is, we are raising, we're revising salaries upwards by 10%, for example. That's the easy way of doing, but it's obviously not that simple. And much more needs to go into it to make sure that the pay design is equitable and those traditional principles are re-looked at in terms of how we structure compensation plans and remuneration packages.
Okay, that's very, very interesting. For me, I think the biggest thing about unfair wage is the fact that women are paid less than men, even though they may be doing the same job. And a lot of the times you'll find that women complain about this. In some cases, there have been, cases where they've tried to stop that. But in South Africa, we are yet to see that.
Yes, what tends to happen is if you look at pay design principles, right? If pay design principles are re-looked at in terms of the moving away from the three measures I talked about, the total guaranteed package, uh-huh. short-term and long-term incentives, if these are applied properly, you'll find that there will be parity between the genders, the outcome, the economic outcome in terms of the mathematical quantification of these concepts, it will arrive at an equal conclusion. What is happening currently is that many employers do not employ or utilize these tools correctly, and this is why you find the disparity and the aspect of no parity between the genders when it comes to compensation.
All right, so let's move on to the next topic, and that's the pros and cons of stockpiling. And I'm going to assume here when you talk about stockpiling, we're talking about food and that kind of thing?
I must begin by saying that while some of us love grocery shopping, some of us hate it, all of us have to do it. So grocery shopping is something that is a must-have to manage a home. After housing, I mean, paying for a home or your basic living expense, the biggest bill is probably the grocery bill, you know, and this is why amid rising inflation, rising fuel costs, it becomes all the more important to consider this whole aspect of how to derive maximum gain from the overall shopping experience and making sure that you do not leave a supermarket with a thinner wallet. The whole issue is, let's go back to first principles. What is stockpiling? Conventionally, if you look at the definition of stockpiling, some people refer to it as a reserve that you keep for in any particular context. It's just a reserve, whether it's a stockpiling of cash, whether it's a stockpiling of investments, a stockpiling of groceries, whatever it is, it's just a reserve of some sort. But for our purposes and for purposes of the discussion regarding consumer consciousness, I would prefer to define stockpiling as buying food or merchant grocery items at rock bottom prices, so that you can gain from the overall experience of saving money. I must add that from an Islamic perspective, the dimension is also important, because when you look at stockpiling, on first impression, if you think about stockpiling and you don't define stockpiling appropriately, then one would be in breach of the prophetic teachings, where if you look at the life of the Prophet ﷺ, his wives and his cohorts, his family, his companions, you would find that the concept of stockpiling is not found. And that is because stockpiling is not defined correctly by ourselves. Whereas if we define stockpiling correctly in terms of what I just said earlier on, where you purchase items at a very decent price so that you can save or utilize economic resources more better, then you find, according to this definition, you're more in line with the teachings of Sayyidina Yusuf alayhi salam, where he predicted or he interpreted the dream of the king in a specific way so that economic resources were optimally utilized. So we find we're still within the paradigm of the Anbiya and the sent messengers of Allah Ta'ala if we define and approach stockpiling with a correct mindset. So that's important. And then before I go into the pros and cons and get some of your input there, I think the whole issue is, when it comes to the topic of stockpiling, it doesn't necessarily mean that it must be done monthly or it must be done every 6 weeks. It doesn't have to be that. There doesn't have to be a fixed cycle of stockpiling of grocery items. It can be very rare on a rare occasion, but again, it comes back to the definition. If you're defining stockpiling as buying something at really rock bottom price, then it depends on when the rock bottom price applies, and that's how frequently the stockpiling happens. Anything shorter than that space, it doesn't happen. You just don't do stockpiling because it's falling out of the ambit of the Sharia definition of what stockpiling means. Let's go on to the pros and cons. Maybe that's something that our listeners even could add in and contribute to the discussion. I'll just start with, I've got a few listed on my end. I'm sure you can contribute there. Let me start with the benefits and the pros of stockpiling. For me, I think the first one is when you do stockpile in the sense of buying things at rock bottom so that when they are actually at full price, you don't have to be buying. The best part for me is the aspect of time saving, because obviously there are better uses of time in any given circumstance, especially in the context of grocery shopping. There are better uses of time and better things to do. So if you've stockpiled and you've bought something at rock bottom at a particular time, obviously it saves you the time of having to go the next time when it's at full price. So the benefit of time saving is definitely something worth shouting about and referring to as a benefit of stockpiling habits. That's the first one in my view. The second one is the all-important one of saving money. Because remember that the more you spend, the thinner that wallet becomes. So when items are bought or purchased at rock-bottom prices or at good, decent prices, sensible prices, then you find that there is saving. If the saving that is being made is then put aside. You know, many a time people save by purchasing things at a good price, but then fail to actually make the distinction between saying, okay, I've saved this much, I've actually saved this much, and I can now allocate this equivalent somewhere else. And what's happening now, if you look at supermarkets, they're giving you this benefit in some way. So let's say you effect your purchases of a whole long list of items, and you bought, I don't know, worth 1,000 rand, for example, and you're leaving the supermarket. On the supermarket, on the tilt slip, it says there, today you have saved, 30 rand or 45 rand or whatever it is. They're giving you some kind of indication of how much you've saved. It's a good habit to say, okay, I'm taking the same amount and I'm doing something with it. I'm putting it aside into a separate account or however you choose to save, but I'm saving that sum of money. This is now how saving takes place if you're really careful about how economic resources are allocated and channeled. So that's the second benefit, the saving money aspect. The third benefit, which I find in stockpiling habits, is the aspect of being better prepared, you know, because if you do stockpile and you do have identify items that can be stockpiled, you find that the day you are in a desperate situation where you have a visitor or you have some unforeseen circumstance at home, there is some reserve that can be tapped into in terms of those specific groceries that have been accumulated or stockpiled back home. And the fourth one from my side, in terms of benefits of stockpiling, is the whole aspect of the advantage of taking taking advantage of wholesale prices. Because keep in mind, supermarkets, in their buying processes, what happens is they purchase items in such a way that they procure it at specific prices such that if they have to resell it, even selling it at a discounted price still allows them to make a profit. Within the whole aspect of supermarket management, managers are trained to do this, where buyers procure merchandise in such a way that it can be sold at a reduced price, and they can also benefit because there is no free lunch. They also will be benefiting. So it helps you to derive or take advantage of wholesale prices and in the process benefit for yourself. So these are just a few pros and benefits of stockpiling from my side. I'm sure there are many more. I'll just take some of your contributions before we go on to the disadvantages that could arise as a result of stockpiling habits.
I think as a female and as a housewife, what we do is basically try to save money when it comes to stockpiling. And that's when you find that, you look at I have this habit which my dad inculcated in me, where I sit down and look at supermarkets that are close by within the same radius that I'm, living in or going to be visiting, and looking at what specials they have. And then I would go and buy whatever I need or is at a good price from those particular supermarkets. But I also understand that sometimes what happens is we see that one supermarket in another area has butter on special, and then you're traveling at least 20 kilometers to the next supermarket to get something else. It's actually worthless because you're spending petrol and wasting, and you think that by buying extra from that particular shop that's 20 kilometers away, you are saving, but you're not actually, because you're using that money up before you even get to the store, the saving that you would have made. So I think when you are doing or want to do stockpiling in that sense, you've got to be very careful about how you actually go about doing it. So planning comes into play, where you check to see where the best prices are, and that you're not going to lose out on those benefits in other ways.
Mm-hmm.
I think for me that's important.
Yeah, I think it's the whole aspect of saving money is probably the key most attractive reason for adopting a stockpiling practice. And as you correctly mentioned, you've got to take into account the overall transaction costs that are involved, the true cost of a purchase, because it's not only the cost of buying the items, it's also the cost of traveling there, the fuel cost, the time which is spent in going so far to procure goods at a good, supposedly good price. So how you define a good price is also important, and consumers need to be aware of it. You need to take into account the full cost. And this is precisely why in the modern context, in the modern world, you find shopping malls are gaining more traction and becoming a more like a model, economic model towards which most countries around the world are gravitating towards. The reason is purely because they try and they tout that you actually save on transaction costs, because it's at one place you procure a number of items. So although we from a pure Islamic context, we would say or regard shopping malls as temples of consumerism. And they are, indeed. But if consumers are responsible and more conscious, then you find that you can accrue benefits of shopping malls or being able to minimize on transaction costs when effecting your ordinary purchases.
Mm-hmm. One of the things you mentioned was time, and I think many of us forget that time is the one commodity that you cannot place a value on, because once it's lost, it's lost. You can't get it back in any way at all. And I, you know, when you spoke about this, when you were saying talking about time, one of the things that struck me was the fact that, you know, there's a hadith, I think, that says the most beloved places of Allah are the mosques, and the most hated of places to Allah are the marketplaces or the markets. And what strikes me is the fact that when we think about it, when you are in a shopping mall, if you are not focused on your on the reasons for being there at that particular time, especially like when we look at the Black Friday sales or any sale for that matter that you may be going for, and you tend to want to, you're saying you're going to get good bargains, time wasted there is actually time you can never get back. And I think that's the biggest loss that as Muslims we can actually accrue.
Definitely. What tends to happen when it comes to time is a failure to realize that in the Quran, or Allah Ta'ala refers to how time is spent and we will be answerable for. So
yes.
You find that in the words of the Quran, Allah Ta'ala says, or referring to the non-disbelievers, that on the day of Qiyamah, they will say, like, take us back. And you know, we didn't have any warner. And the Quran says that, وَقَدْ جَاءَكُمُ النَّذِيرُ, you know, you had a warner. In the context of defining that warner, the word nadir in the Quran, the Mufassirin has given three meanings. And I'll try to recall all of them just for purposes of deriving lesson from them. The one warner, the nadir that Allah Ta'ala is referring to when it comes to the usage of time, is the aspect of the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, obviously, that he himself is the warner in terms of how you spend your time, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the Mufassirin have said that that particular word refers to the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam as a warner in terms of how people spend their time. And then the second meaning allocated to that word, nadir, or warner in the Quran, and this is according to the Tafsir of Ibn Abbas, radiallahu anhu, where he says that the warner refers to the coming of white hair. The moment you see white hair anywhere on one's body, that is an indication of a warner. Your time is running out.
Old age,
you need to save time and maximize, utilize it optimally. That's the second meaning. The third meaning attached to the word nadir and warner that Allah Ta'ala is referring to is the aspect of the coming of children and grandchildren. The moment those phenomena manifest itself in our life, we find that those are warners, those are telltale signs that something is happening in your life, you need to really make amends. So there's very little time for spending or dedicating the resource of time towards shopping or spending habits. This is why, and precisely, that when after a spending spree, you'll spend 3 or 4 hours and you'll come home and you'll find there's an element of regret or remorse in the heart for how you spent your time. But if you spend the same amount of time in a masjid, as you mentioned there, that element of regret will not be there. In fact, there will be, if anything, there will be a feeling of fulfillment and satisfaction.
Absolutely. And I think time for us, we don't realize the pricelessness of it.
Yes, definitely.
Okay, that's interesting. So tell us about the disadvantages of stockpiling.
Yes. You know, the first disadvantage I've got, you know, on my end is the aspect of it obviously can't be done for fresh produce items. So you can't stockpile fresh milk, or you can't stockpile vegetables maybe. And there are specific items which are naturally meant to be purchased on a more regular, frequent basis. So you have to go into a supermarket or some store of that matter to effect purchase of these items. I suppose for us, when we talk about these items as a disadvantage, you know, in terms of stockpiling habits, then you find we've got to identify a solution, because we can't identify the disadvantage without providing a solution. So I would say the solution is, for those specific items, strictly adhere to a list. The list is made. We need cabbage, we need spinach, we need fresh milk, and those are the items that you go to the shop for. Make sure that you don't leave with anything else from those aisles which are luring you to take other sweet and sugary stuff. So that's the first disadvantage of when it comes to the topic of stockpiling, the whole issue of not being able to stockpile specific grocery items. second disadvantage is the aspect of space, because not every household has got additional space to keep items in bulk. Sometimes in some homes, there are so many spaces where things are kept that the individual even forgets what they have. So
yes,
they're purchasing more and more, not realizing that there is so much of a particular item at home, you know. So space is one constraint or so-called disadvantage of stockpiling habits. So no matter how good the price is, you simply just don't have the space to keep it. In that regard, I suppose the solution is to keep one place, you know. Keep one space where you keep most of your stockpile items. Obviously, you've got to make a distinction between detergent and food items, which cannot be kept together.
Yes,
but if it's food items and they all can stay in one place and you have an inventory of what is there, then you can cater for stockpiling and keeping a bulk quantity of tin food maybe, or some kind of packet soups or whatever it is. So space is one constraint. And the third disadvantage is the aspect of the emotional pain that one undergoes when it comes to having to fork out a large sum of money to effect that purchase of an item that you want to stockpile. So that emotional strain is there to spend so much or to outlay so much, but the long-term gain is there if there's discipline to make sure that after having stockpiled a particular item, it's not going to be purchased at its regular price for the next, 6 to 8 weeks, maybe even more.
Mm-hmm. I think one of, you know, since you're talking about the fact that we're looking at food in particular, some of the things that we need to take into consideration when we do decide to do stockpiling is checking out dates on the foodstuff that we are purchasing, especially canned items or, you know, things that can be kept for a while, like your packet soups. Make sure you check the dates out. You don't want to buy something that has a lifespan of 2 weeks and you think you can keep it for the next year, like in the case of canned items. And then also checking to see that the cans are in good condition. They're not, not swelling at the tops or the sides. They're not in any way dented or they're not rusting. That kind of thing. Also, I think a lot of the times, because we see things on special and we think we're stockpiling to save, it also becomes a bit of the sense of greed seems to creep in, and we think that if we buy more, we'll be saving more. And you find that you buy it and you keep it, and by the time you actually do use it, it's not usable anymore. So you've actually wasted. Just things to take into consideration before you go about stockpiling, especially food items.
Indeed. You know, what I'm doing is, together with discussing the pros and cons of stockpiling, I am accumulating putting together a piece on how to make it work. So on your point about making sure that the expiry dates of items are adhered to, in that regard, I'm just going to leverage and say that maybe at another time I'll pick up on how to make stockpiling work and provide specific tips on how it can work and things that can be done to make sure that the habit of stockpiling or the practice of stockpiling is something that can be achieved, and it can achieve benefits or accrue benefits in terms of saving money, not only saving money but also optimally managing one's life and lifestyle.
Yes, absolutely. Because I know when I was taught about putting away groceries, my parents were very fussy about looking at the dates. Older stuff had to be brought to the front, newer things had to go to the back. And my children tell me I'm very anal about these things, but I understand the logic behind it. So having to teach them that is difficult, because obviously they think that I'm being silly, but that's what they do in supermarkets as well. And you've got to be careful, because you find people in the know will generally take a loaf of bread from the back and not from the front, because they know that the fresher loaves are at the back.
Mm. You know, what I can do is maybe even provide at another time the specific resources to help people stockpile, because there's an amazing amount of resources that I've come across that I can share with people, and I'll probably do that for our listeners at another segment, the list that can be done, or even the aspect of, depending on your family size, how to stockpile, or the specific items that can be stockpiled and which one cannot be. As obvious as it may seem, you'll be surprised the list that I've come across is something that I can share maybe at another time, inshallah.
Inshallah, that would be great. Okay, if we're done with that, then the next one is, we're looking at first-time property buyers. What questions do they need to be asking?
You know, I must acknowledge that the aspect of property buying is not a pro-poor topic. We always like to maintain topics that are pro-poor and the bottom end of our community and society. But be that as it may, occasionally there are also individuals who are in that position to be buying property, and as wealthy as they may be, many of them don't realize that there are specific questions that are that seldom come about and are not asked, or they're not even aware that these specific questions need to be asked. So for purposes of your request to provide questions that property buyers need to be asking, I just want to suffice on five questions that many property buyers simply ignore and just don't know that they need to be asking these five things. And I'll keep it to that. Keeping it to five means that the list is much more. I'm not aware of those other questions, but these are the five. The first one is to ask the agent, the property agent, for the CMA. The CMA is the comparative market analysis of the property. That comparative market analysis of the property gives you a good idea of the value of the property. It explains basically how the value of the property was determined. So if they're telling you the property is worth $1.2 million, for example, the CMA gives you an idea of how that value is arrived at. That comparative market analysis is something worth asking for. That's the first question. The second question is to ask the property agent about patent defects. I'm not talking about latent defects. In law, we have two types of defects. We have patent defects and latent defects. The patent defects are defects which should be apparent to any ordinary onlooker who's a non-expert, basically. A latent defect requires some kind of expertise, maybe the rock or the kind of soil or ground that the property is built on or something of that. So that would be very much a latent defect. But ask an agent about patent defects. And then in this regard, basically it all boils down to whether the seller disclosed everything. So you've got to make sure that everything is specified in the sale agreement. To sum it up. That's the second question. The third question is to ask whether the plans of the property are approved and if there is an undertaking by the seller to provide these plans. Because many a time you find that you purchase a property and only later do you realize that the plans are not approved. Suddenly you have the municipality coming to you and wanting to demolish it. And I know it happens rarely, but you never know when one could be in this predicament. So it pays to ask whether the plans of the property are in fact approved and all above board. The fourth question is whether there are any hidden costs such as replacement of equipment maybe in the property which is not included in the sale. So some specific forms of equipment may need to be replaced and that will incur additional costs for you as a property buyer who is maybe on a tight budget. So the asking about the hidden costs is the fourth question that is seldom asked and should be asked. Now, the final question is, what exactly is included and not included in the sale? And if anything has to be removed and replaced by the seller, it's important to make sure that those are stipulated in the sale agreement. So many a time you find property buyers simply walk around and don't identify specific items that may possibly not be included in the sale agreement, in the actual sale of the property.
Mm-hmm.
So property buyers will ask about apparent things like movable furniture and so forth, but there are specific items that you've got to take note of when you're walking around to make sure that you inquire whether those things are going to be part of the sale or not part of the sale. And it could be odd fittings, maybe light fittings or something. It's something attached to the property. You just take it for granted that it's there, but it's possible that maybe a water feature, the seller is not intending to keep it there. As permanent as it looks to you as a property buyer, but the seller may not be willing to include it. So those are the five questions that I think should be asked by every property buyer. One is the aspect of the comparative market analysis. The second one is the aspect of patent defect. The third one is whether the plans of the property are approved. The fourth is whether there are any hidden costs. And the fifth one is the specific movable or immovable items which are included or not included in the sale agreement.
I think the one with regards to, you know, items that are included in the sale is very important. I had a friend who purchased a large flat here in Durban, and when they eventually got to move into the flat, they hadn't checked to see if the jacuzzi in one of the bathrooms was going to remain, and when they got there, it had been taken out.
Mm.
And because it wasn't part of the sale, so it left them with an entire bathroom that was basically unfinished, and cost them.
There's a classic example of something that looks so permanent and you take for granted that it's going to be part of the sale, whereas it may not be in terms of the view of the seller.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So it's important, I think, as first-time buyers to maybe get yourself a little more knowledgeable about the things to find out. And these are some of the questions that you should be taking into consideration when you're speaking to your agent or even the owner of the property when you are negotiating the sale. So JazakAllah khair for that. I think that's very, very important. And our last topic for today is something on money for children.
Yes, you know, when it comes to money, I'm sure everyone agrees that there's a growing need for us to approach or address issues of money and investing and so forth for as early as the 5 or 10 years old. You know, that's as early as which we need to be starting in terms of talking about the aspect of money to our children. Interestingly, there's a financial corporation called Ford Asset Management, FORT. Ford Asset Management have recently published the first in a planned series of picture books to teach children aged 4 to 7 the basic concepts of investing. So basically, I've had a look at one of the books called More Than Enough. More Than Enough is a book that, let me just go on to the series in general, which aims to explore concepts like time, saving, income generation, compounding, which is a very crucial aspect amid the reality of inflation and the world we live in, the aspect of diversification of investments, risk, and the all important, probably the most important aspect of patience when it comes to investing for the long term, because patience is indeed something that is running out across all levels of society and in all contexts, even the aspect of investing and generating money and resources. So this is the overall series aims to address all of these aspects of relating to money. More Than Enough, the book itself, the one I saw, is a story about a young squirrel who sets out with her mother one autumn morning to collect acorns. Now, interestingly, the book doesn't take into account or doesn't utilize any of the complex jargon. There's absolutely no reference to money, and what I like is that there's no hint about greed and the whole concept of how greed applies to money and investing.
Yes.
So it's very presented in a very moral on a very moral basis, and which is why I find it very attractive for ordinary Muslims to be picking up to impart the important lessons to children. So the book is called More Than Enough, and I'm sure it can be obtained from many bookstores, well-established ones. Alternatively, you can email the company on info@fort.co.za. So it's info@fort.co.za, and I believe that they are dispensing a few free copies to parents who are keen to disseminate or share this resource with their children.
That's very interesting. I think it's a very good idea as well, alhamdulillah, for children to be learning in that manner. It's easy for them to understand.
Yes, definitely. What's interesting about these stories is if I look at the one about More Than Enough, this young squirrel, it's all about an ordinary squirrel, but as many expertly written children books are, the books carry a very subtle message. And that message is very well crafted and designed without the child actually realizing that there's a deeper meaning to this whole thing. And that is basically how child psychology works. The messages are embedded in the mind for usage later on in terms of the subconscious mind coming into play in later years.
All right. Mufti, JazakAllah khair for that. We are almost at the end of today's show, but it's been a very educational and informative one, and we'll talk to you again next week, Sunday, inshallah.
Inshallah. JazakAllah khair for having me.
Ameen. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.